In 1982, Dan Scheckman of Iowa State University and the Ames Laboratory discovered a type of crystal so strange, so unusual, it upended the scientific world. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we spend the hour listening back to my conversation from earlier this year with Dan Scheckman, the 2011 Nobel Laureate in Chemistry. We'll hear the story behind his discovery in 1982 of quasi-crystals and how he had to endure ridicule from colleagues who didn't believe it, and how it forced scientists to reconsider the very nature of matter. Nobel Laureate Dan Scheckman, right after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. And my guest this hour is Dan Scheckman, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. Scheckman was awarded the Nobel for his discovery of quasicrystals, which took place in 1982. The discovery of this type of crystal was at the time so strange and unusual in the scientific community that it upset the prevailing views on the atomic structure of matter and led to a paradigm shift in chemistry. Scheckman is a professor of materials science and engineering at Iowa State University. He's also a research scientist for the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory and the Philip Tobias Professor of Materials Science at the Technion, Israel Institute of Technology. Dan Scheckman came to our studios earlier this week. I began by asking him to set the scene for this discovery in 1982 and explain what quasicrystals are.
Quasicrystals are materials which are crystals. That means that they are ordered. But unlike many other crystals, which are periodic, these are not periodic.
So periodic, you mean they are in an ordered pattern, but this pattern does not repeat.
That is correct. Now, if you want to tell your listeners, if they look on a repeating pattern such as tiles on the floor, mm-hmm. or a design on a rug in a hotel, usually it is periodic, which means that there is a certain distance between motifs which repeats itself. And crystals are like that when they are periodic. Mm-hmm. Quasi-periodic crystals have order, but they're not periodic. There's no periodicity. There's no motif of any size which repeats itself.
Okay. So why would that make a difference in an atomic structure, that it has order but does not repeat itself, is not periodic?
Yeah. Well, you know, the science of crystallography started really in the year 1912 with the famous experiment by von Laue and his co-workers, who performed the first X-ray diffraction experiment and proved that atoms in crystals are indeed ordered. But all the crystals that they have studied and all the crystals that have been studied for the 70 years after 1912 up until 1982, all these crystals were ordered and periodic. Mm-hmm. And so a paradigm became accepted. The paradigm was accepted by everybody, which made a definition of a crystal to be something like: a crystal is a material in which atoms are ordered and periodic. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered quasi-periodic materials, or quasicrystals as they are nicknamed, it created a paradigm shift in our understanding of the structure of matter. Suddenly, after 70 years in which hundreds of thousands of crystals were studied, which are all periodic, here we have a new class of materials which are quasi-periodic. And what followed was that a new definition of crystals emerged from the International Union of Crystallography.
Mm-hmm. And so in that 70-year period, it was the fact that they had found no crystals that were not periodic. Was that ever challenged, or was it just hardened like a crystal to be conventional wisdom?
You see, I don't think that it has ever been challenged. Nobody proposed anything but periodic crystals. And the discovery was made, it was a serendipity. I didn't look for that. Mm-hmm. It just happened that I saw that. But I pursued studying it until I understood what we have. And that was a great change.
Take us back to that moment. You said you weren't looking for it. You happened on it by chance. This is in 1982.
Correct.
Describe that day and that moment.
I know the details of that day and the moment because everything is written in my logbook. You see, every scientist should and does write his experiments in a notebook. And I have that notebook from that day. It's the transmission electron microscope notebook. And the date was April 8, 1982. And I was working on the TEM. TEM is a transmission electron microscope, studying an alloy of aluminum manganese, aluminum and 25% manganese, which I have prepared before. And it was a rapidly solidified alloy. The project title was Development of New Aluminum Alloys for Different Purposes. And so this is one alloy that I have studied that morning. And I took a few pictures, and then I saw something which was extremely strange. It was a diffraction pattern, electron diffraction pattern. In electron microscope, you take electron diffractions. And the diffraction pattern had a tenfold rotational symmetry. Turned out later on that it was fivefold, but I could not know based on that single experiment that it was really fivefold. And then I noted tenfold with three question mark. And I did that because tenfold rotational symmetry is forbidden in periodic crystals, and no other crystals were known at the time.
Mm-hmm. Why is that forbidden?
Well,
forbidden?
Yeah, well, let me start by giving you an example. If you try to, let's say you try to tile a floor with tiles. If you have square tiles, you can clearly do it without gaps. If you have triangular tiles, you can do it without gaps. If you have hexagonal tiles, you can do it without gaps. But if you have fivefold tiles, that means pentagonal tiles, you cannot tile a floor without gaps with pentagonal tiles. So fivefold rotational symmetry of a floor or of a two-dimensional space is forbidden. And you cannot tile a floor with anything that has higher symmetry, like sevenfold or eightfold without gaps, and so on. So this is also true in space. So the allowed symmetries in periodic materials are 2, 3, 4, and 6, no 5, and nothing beyond 6. And so when I saw the tenfold, I said, tenfold? That was very strange.
Mm. So you noticed this, you made this note, tenfold, three question marks. Did you immediately recognize what it was? Did you think it was a mistake?
No. It was not an artifact. That was clear to me. I am a good electron microscopist, so...
An artifact would have been a mistake.
Artifact would have been a mistake, something that really is something else, not what I thought. But what I knew from the very first day, after a few experiments, I knew what it was not. And it was not twinned crystals. I didn't know what it was yet. And I say that because some people rejected my findings and 12 years later even rejected my findings, claiming that these are twinned crystals, which I knew from day one they were not.
And not just anybody. I believe you might be referring to Linus Pauling, a leading 20th century chemist, also a Nobel laureate. He died in 1994, but he died convinced that you were wrong about this.
That is correct. At least this is what he said in public. Deep in his heart, I suspect that he suspected that he was wrong, but he never said that.
Why would someone, such a learned person, not be able to see what you see? It seems to us non-scientists that this should be cut and dried. If you see it, it is.
Okay. Well, you know, let me tell you something which I discovered along the line. In the frontier of science, when things are not yet in the textbooks, in the frontier, when you have a major discovery like this, people have their beliefs. It's like a religion. Can you convince one person that his religion is wrong and the other religion is right? You can never do that. Same thing in science, in the frontier. People believe in things. Now, Linus Pauling, Professor Linus Pauling, indeed was an eminent scientist, the father and idol of the American Chemical Society. He was one of the most eminent scientists, chemists of the 20th century, really a distinguished person. He got the Nobel twice, by the way. The second time, the first time was for chemistry, the second time was for peace. He fought against nuclear armament. But he was very stubborn, and he believed in himself more than he deserved to believe in himself. That means that the man made not one mistake. He made several mistakes in his career, major mistakes in his career, and he still believed that he was right. He had a wrong model, for instance, for the DNA, for the double helix. He had a wrong model. He was an eminent scientist, but not a humble scientist, and that's not very good.
Mm. If you've just joined us, my guest is Professor Danny Shechtman. He is the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, professor of materials science and engineering at Iowa State University, also a research scientist at the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory. Shechtman's discovery of quasicrystals, and this is what we're talking about, upended the scientific world because it forced scientists to reconsider the very nature of matter. Those are the words of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in announcing the prize. Danny Shechtman, with all this resistance, and this is also a reason why you were selected by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, you didn't give up. Was there a time when you said, you know, I may have it wrong?
No. No. You see, I was a professional electron microscopist. I was an expert in electron microscopists, and I am my worst critic. I have repeated my experiments several times, and then I convinced myself that the results from day one, from the first hour of work, were all correct. There was nothing to amend, nothing to think that something was wrong there. No, everything was fine. Now, that doesn't mean that I was not open to talk to people and to hear other ideas. But you see, when science is really experimental, when you come with proven experimental results, then I was willing to listen to other people. Mm. If they came up with other experimental results that contradict my results, this was not the case. All the people that rejected my results were theoreticians with their ideas, and their ideas were wrong, very simple. No, I didn't think for any moment to give up because I knew I was right.
Is there a lesson for science as a whole or perhaps life as a whole? As we all walk around with our preconceived notions and conventions, what lesson is there for scientists and non-scientists out there?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. In my talks, I talk about the new definition of a crystal. You know, the International Union of Crystallography accepted quasi-periodic materials 3 years after the first publication. The first publication came up in 1984, and now the definition of a crystal is humble and it is open. Mm. And that was not the definition before. And a humble, open scientist or a humble, open person who is willing to talk to other people, listen to their ideas, is a good scientist and is a good person.
How can a definition be humble? I know person. But...
Ah, well, you know, I don't have the definition before me, but the definition does not say a crystal is. It says by crystal we mean. That new definition describes crystal, first of all, not in very definite terms. It says by crystal we mean, and so on. It also explained crystal not looking at the real space of where the atoms are, but looking at the diffraction pattern. It's a not very definite definition. It doesn't say crystal is something that is. No. It says about what we mean, and essentially they use very soft words in the definition. This is a marvelous scientific definition. Probably a single definition like this exists in science, so humble. And it means that we are open to new ideas. We are willing to accept more types of crystals. This is wonderful.
And you can also conduct your life like that.
That's what I'm saying, exactly. You know, be open to listen to other people. Talk to them about your ideas, talk to them about their ideas, your concept of the world, their concept of the world. Nobody is necessarily right because his parents told him that that's the way it should be. You know, people should be more open.
Let's talk about some of the practical applications of quasi-crystals and the properties that quasi-crystals have that make them especially useful. Where are we finding them used now?
Well, there are only a few uses. I will give you a couple of them. There are not very many of them. I wouldn't get the Nobel Prize for the applications of quasi-periodic materials. But let's start with a short introduction. You see, before you use any material for any application, it must have a certain property or a certain set of properties which are a unique combination for that material. And that includes mechanical properties, it may include corrosion properties, it may include aesthetic properties, it may include price, and other properties. And if the combination is right, you can use it. So let me give you a couple of examples where it has been used. One example is a Swedish steel. There's a Swedish company named Sandvik, and they have many products. They produce, among other things, a wonderful steel which is extremely strong and ductile and stainless and precipitation-hardened, amazing steel. And that steel has its properties because it is strengthened by tiny, very small particles which are quasi-crystalline. So that's use number one. Number two, one of the properties of quasi-periodic materials, or some of them at least, is that they have low friction properties and no stick properties, like metallic Teflon. Mm-hmm. So there's a company in France that coats these frying pans with quasi-periodic coating and produce something like a metallic Teflon, which means you can make your omelet or filet mignon on it and it doesn't stick. And it is better than Teflon because it is very hard and doesn't scratch. You can use a knife to cut your steak in the frying pan, and the coating will not be damaged. But of course, your knife will be damaged.
Professor Schechtman, you received a call from the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in October of 2011, telling you were to receive the Nobel Prize. Can you tell us about that call?
Yeah, you know, I never knew what is the date in which the Nobel Prize in Chemistry is announced. I never knew that I was a candidate for the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. I knew that several times I was a candidate for the Nobel Prize in Physics, but never knew about chemistry. And so that day was just a regular day in my office. It was my office at the Technion in Haifa, Israel. I was working at my computer. The time was 11:15, October 5. And I have a telephone call. No, I pick up the phone and said, "Danny speaking." And they said, "Hello, this is the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Please hold the line. Very important message." And I said to myself, "Uh-oh."
You knew.
Well, I suspected, you know, very important message from the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences cannot mean very many things. I have received a prize from them before, by the way. It's called the Aminov Prize, which was announced more or less the same way. So, of course, the committee people talked to me on the phone and told me that I have received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And my first question was, "And who else is with me?" And they said, "Oh, you're alone? You're the discoverer." Uh-huh. I was really expecting other colleagues of mine to join me in Stockholm, but they have decided in a different way. So at that point, they said, well, we ask you not to tell anybody for half an hour, and at 11:45, we will announce it, 11:45. And so I left my computer, and I was just gazing at my room, thinking, what does it mean? Now what? What will happen now? And I was just sitting there for about 20 minutes, and then I called my wife. My wife is also a professor in another university in Haifa, and told her. And then 10 minutes later, they announced it. And when they announced it, hell broke loose. I mean, people started streaming to my office, and hundreds upon hundreds of them, and it was like, people rushing to a football game.
So your discovery now, because of your discovery, people are many, the world is paying attention to you, unlike any attention you've been given in the past. How does that Nobel Prize recognition, now that you've savored it for many months, compare with simply being recognized by the scientific community in your area?
Well, it's a different phase in one's life. I'm a material scientist, and I call it a martensitic transformation in one's life. I will explain. In material science, we know about two major types of transformation from one phase to another. One is a diffusion transformation, a transformation from one phase to another. It takes place over time, usually at high temperatures, and it happens slowly. Martensitic transformation is something that happens within a split of a second, and the whole phase transforms into another phase, and this is the way the Nobel Prize changed my life.
I really like that you see your even in your celebrity, you see it in terms of a material that you study, a materials transformation. How do you find that you're being treated differently now that you're a Nobel laureate?
Well, people think that I'm wiser. I'm not. I am the same person. But I have quite a few ideas that I want to promote, and before I could promote them on a small scale. Now I have ears of more prominent people listening to me, and maybe I can change things on a larger scale.
A conversation I had with Dan Shechtman, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. Shechtman was awarded the Nobel for his discovery of quasicrystals, which took place in 1982. Shechtman is a professor of materials science and engineering at Iowa State University. He's also a research scientist for the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory and the Philip Tobias Professor of Materials Science at the Technion, Israel Institute of Technology. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll hear Shechtman's thoughts on entrepreneurship, technology, science, education, and more. That's when River to River continues in just a few minutes. This is Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Now back to my conversation with Dan Shechtman, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. Shechtman was awarded the Nobel for his discovery of quasicrystals, which took place in 1982. Shechtman's discovery of quasicrystals upended the scientific world because it forced scientists to reconsider the very nature of matter. Those are the words of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in announcing the Nobel Prize. Shechtman is a professor of materials science and engineering at Iowa State University. He's also a research scientist for the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory. In this part of our conversation, we started off by talking about one of Shechtman's concerns, entrepreneurship. Shechtman began with an example about countries keeping and developing their own raw materials.
Many nations in Africa now see better times financially. And that is because China is buying raw materials from the African countries. China is buying a lot of raw materials from African countries. They have more incomes. Everybody is happy. So you can say, well, African countries sell raw materials. Well, maybe they cannot make any products from the raw materials. I just heard that here in Iowa and in the United States, we have a deal with China to buy soybeans, large quantity of soybeans.
Yes.
Well, soybeans are raw materials. And renewable, admittedly, but this is raw material. And the Chinese will make products from our soybeans. Why don't we make products from soybeans? Why don't we invest in designing, inventing products based on our excellent raw materials?
The traditional answer to that is that labor costs are so much less in China, right?
Well, we have good living here in the United States. We still can make excellent products. Besides, you know, the local market is huge in the United States. If we make products that nobody has from soybeans, we conquer the world with products made of soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
Why sell raw materials like Africa? We shouldn't do that.
Okay.
Here comes entrepreneurship. Okay, and this was an introduction to entrepreneurship. You see, everything I say from now on is my opinion. It's not based on facts. It's just based on the way I look at the world. I think that in the world of my grandchildren and their grandchildren, the only countries will survive when natural resources are exhausted. The only countries that will survive are the countries in which technological entrepreneurship thrives. And those countries will live. Other countries will just disappear. That doesn't mean that the people will disappear, but it means that there will be internal wars because of fights over dwindling natural resources, and waves of immigrations will start to flood the industrialized world, and we will not be able to control that. And if you think that it's my imagination, it already has started. Okay. So now what can we do? Well, what can we do? We can teach entrepreneurship. Can you teach an entrepreneur? Yeah, you can teach, because you can motivate people to open startups. And the first people we should approach are the engineers and scientists, because they have the tools to open startups. We just have to motivate them to do so and to tell them where the stumbling blocks are and where the stepping stones are. I have been doing that for 25 years at the Technion, my university in Israel, and I have been teaching a class of technological entrepreneurship. It is a large class, and by now I have about 10,000 graduates. There are 10,000 engineers in Israel that took my class. And over time, Israel became a startup nation. And entrepreneurship is everywhere. When I started teaching the class, there was one venture capital fund in the whole country. And it was not venture. They invested only in something that was sure to bring them money. Now there are billions upon billions invested, and so on. So countries with a spirit of entrepreneurship, like Israel, like Sweden, like several other countries in the Western world, will survive economically. And we should all do that also here in the United States, and also here in Iowa, because we have wonderful raw materials, we have wonderful minds. We just have to direct them to think about entrepreneurship. They can do it.
You mentioned that education is at the top of your list as well, using the voice you now have as a Nobel laureate. What specifically?
Well, I think that we should start teaching our young children about science, about rational thinking, about logics from a very early age, from the kindergarten. Children 5 to 6 can learn a lot about science, and I will expect them to know that there are quantities that can be measured all around them. So I would want young children to know how to measure length with a ruler, how to measure temperature, and understand what does it mean, hot and cold. I want them to learn how to measure weight and understand what does it mean that one thing is heavy and another is not. I'll measure volume and note it down and follow, let me give an example, follow the growth of a plant, measure the height every day and make a graph of the height, but do it themselves. Understand development and then I would expect them to know that everything that can be measured, you can talk about it in rational terms and explain to them the importance of science so that they would love science. And when they go to elementary schools and then to high schools, they will be inclined to study the sciences and the languages, which is mathematics and the different languages. And if you come up with generations like these people who are educated in science, then you can make a big change in the world. And so I think that we should start working on that now.
You are also using your recently acquired celebrity to promote nuclear power. This is in the wake of the accident in Japan. That's a harder sell than it used to be.
Well, it's maybe hard to sell to the public, but it should not be hard to sell to the decision makers, because in the future we will have an energy crisis if we don't develop new resources. And of course, here in Iowa, wind power is going very well, but it in order for it to produce all the energy we need in Iowa, we need a lot of that windmills or whatever you call them to produce electricity. And then when there is no wind, what will you do? You have to store that energy somehow. It doesn't work easily. Using coal is very bad, as you know. It's a disaster to our world. The amount of CO2 and sulfur that is released is really bad news. Nuclear energy is clean. It is safe. I repeat it. It is safe. Although we had a few accidents in modern times, and I can tell you about this shortly. But to produce the large amount of energy that we need, in addition to wind energy and sun energy, we will have to have nuclear reactors. Yes, there was a Three Mile Island accident. It was a minor accident. There was Chernobyl, a horrible accident, but it was not only a human mistake, it was a human, how shall I put it, a combination of stupidity and irresponsibility. That should not happen. And the last one in Fukushima in Japan was a bad design considering the elements, which was designed to a certain tsunami, but not to this kind of tsunami. Okay, so now we know. We learned the lesson. And here in Iowa, we have no oceans to do that. Here in Iowa, we don't have major earthquakes. And we still can design excellent nuclear reactors that will be strong enough to withstand high impact earthquakes. So I don't see any reason why not to develop nuclear reactors. And you see, in order to develop nuclear reactors and build them, we have to design better reactors now, regardless of the public opinion. If you don't want to build them now, okay, fine, find other ways. But you should, or we should, develop new types of nuclear reactors. So then when this decision comes, we will have the blueprints for new reactors, and it takes some time to build them.
And do you think that the other problem that critics raise, the long-term storage of radioactive waste, will eventually be solved?
It must be resolved, of course. We have to solve. It is a real problem, but okay, we have to resolve this problem. We'll find a way to do that.
Danny Schechtman is my guest, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, professor of materials science and engineering at Iowa State University. You won the Nobel Prize for your discovery of quasicrystals. It is a crystal so strange to the scientific community, unusual that it upset prevailing views, conventional wisdom on the atomic structure of matter. It led to a paradigm shift in chemistry. But it's interesting that they were arranged in patterns, you say, not periodic, but ordered, and that these patterns, these non-repeating patterns, have since been identified in Islamic designs at a 14th century palace in Spain, a 15th century shrine in Iran. They also come into works made by M.C. Escher. Are you surprised at all that this structure shows up in artwork from hundreds of years ago even?
Well, you know, I don't think that Escher has quasi-periodic design. He has fivefold motifs, oh yeah. And so do the designs of the in Iran and in Morocco and in Spain, the Moor designs. They have fivefold motifs, but I'm not sure that they have quasi-periodicity. But let's say that they do. Just for the sake of argument. Okay, so it only means that they had aesthetic view of the world, which included these designs. They didn't know about quasi-periodicity, I can prove you that.
So this is just an interesting side note to your story, not a connection of art and science and religion.
Well, let's forget religion. I don't think that it has anything to do with this. I mean, we can discuss religion on another matter. But I don't think that they knew about the quasi-periodic equation in mathematics. I don't think they knew it. And yes, you know, it has aesthetic value with fivefold motifs, as well as fourfold motifs and eightfold motifs and other. These are all point groups. These are all motifs that can be arranged in certain ways on a floor or on a two-dimensional space. And you know, there is, of course, the golden ratio or the Fibonacci number, which are linked. This Fibonacci number is linked to quasi-periodicity in crystals. And also you can find them in art. You can find this ratio, this famous ratio in art, or at least so people claim. It's very difficult to prove that this is the case. But the golden ratio is an irrational number, which is 1 plus root 5 divided by 2. If you have a rational number near that number, how can you tell by looking at a picture that this is exactly the irrational number and not the rational number? You cannot tell. But something around the golden ratio has aesthetic value, and I agree with that.
Let's go to the other point. You are intimately acquainted with the atomic structure of our world, of our universe. So what are your thoughts about the existence or non-existence of a higher power behind it all?
Oh, no, I don't want to be dragged into that. No.
No?
No
comment on the watchmaker analogy that... The complex makings of our universe have to have a designer behind them, just as a watch does?
No, I don't have any comment on that.
You came to Iowa State University in 2004. Why?
Oh, before that, I was used to work in the summers at NBS or then NIST. And they offered me to join here, and I appreciate Ames Lab very much, and I appreciate ISU very much. So I said, yeah, I will come. During all my career, I was used to do my sabbatical and or spend summers in the United States, and all my stays were in national laboratories. I admire the American system of national laboratories. So I did my postdoc at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, working in what was known as ARL, Aerospace Research Laboratories, that was abolished in 1974. Then I worked at for many years at NBS, also a DOC, a national laboratory, and now here at Ames, which is a DOE national laboratory. These are wonderful laboratories, and not very many countries have such excellent laboratories.
Danny Schechtman, you are an Israeli citizen, born in 1941 in Tel Aviv, before the creation of Israel. Tell us a little bit about your childhood in Israel.
Okay.
A memory that stands out, and perhaps a memory that connects with your scientific career.
Okay, I'll tell you one story. I was a very curious young boy, and really, really opened my eyes to look at the nature around me. I could recognize each and every flower, and I cut them into little pieces to see what's inside, and understood, not only knew the nature around me, but really understood as a young boy. But as a story, when I was, I think I was about 10 years old, fifth grader, we had a teacher of what that now it's called science. At the time it was called nature. It was the teacher of nature. And he came to the class one day, and he told us that we have a microscope in the school. It was a little bench black microscope. And I said, oh, wow, can you bring it to class? And he said, oh, yeah, I will bring it to class. And so from there on, every week I bugged him, oh, can you bring it? Can you bring it next week? So finally he brought it to class, and he said, okay, Dan, at the time they called me Dan, you were showed so much interest, so you'll be first to look at it. And he put a specimen in there. It was a leaf of something. I forget what the specimen was. But I was amazed. This was the first time I looked through a microscope and saw this wonderful world in high magnification, in wonderful resolution. And then so I looked at it and looked. And then he said, okay, Dan, now you sit down. Let somebody else look at it. And he said, no, wait a minute. I just couldn't leave the microscope. And then, so this was an example of a good teacher, but that teacher was not very good. Because I said, well, can you bring it to class every week? He said, no. I said, well, can you take me to the storage room where you have the microscope and I can work on it myself? He said, no. And I never saw that microscope again, which is a bad thing to do for a teacher. If you see a child who is so interested in something, you should encourage him, not just take the tool away from him. Well, in later years, I became an electron microscopist, and this machine is where I discovered quasicrystals.
And when you have students or you're teaching people, you look for that look in their eyes and that fascination and that eager attitude and encourage it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I encourage students to come to my office. Any student that comes to my office and wants to talk about something, I really encourage them. Sometimes I sit for hours with students with bright eyes, and we discuss things that they didn't mean to ask even. You know, as the conversation goes, things develop, and I hear their ideas, and I tell them what I think about different things, and I open their eyes to new phenomena in nature. Yep, I do it a lot.
What are your plans to do with the prize money? How much is that, by the way?
It's 10 million krons, so it's about $1.4 million.
Do you have plans for that money?
Oh, everything goes to two purposes. One is income tax, and the other is education of my family.
Very good. Well, we wish you well. We really have enjoyed the fact that you have given us your time today.
Well, thank you so much.
My conversation with Dan Schechtman, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. Schechtman was awarded the Nobel for his discovery of quasicrystals, which took place in 1982. He's a professor of materials science and engineering at Iowa State University, also a research scientist for the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory, and the Philip Tobias Professor of Materials Science at the Technion, Israel Institute of Technology. River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. We also had help from Jason Burns in Ames. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to our website, iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at river2river@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.